Welcome to Greatness, where the world's leading thinkers share their ideas about how to create greatness, great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. Why be good when you can be great?
This is Gretchen Gagel, and I am so excited to welcome my good friend, Dr. Pamela Meyer, to the Greatness Podcast. Pamela is an expert in leadership agility, an author, and a speaker, and as I said, a good friend, and I'm thrilled to have you on the Greatness Podcast again.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Gretchen.
Yeah, we haven't seen each other for a while, but back when I was digging around in my PhD on agility, gosh, I completed that in 2018, so we've known each other for at least 5 years.
Yeah.
I was seeking out the top, the leading experts in the globe around leadership, leadership agility, agility in general, and that's how Pamela and I met. And before we dive into your new fabulous book, and I'm going to talk about your other fabulous book that is how I found you, I love to ask my guests, what has occurred in your life that has led you to be passionate about leadership agility?
Yeah, that it's really a thread that's run through everything. And, you know, I started out in the theater as a director and producer, and my work continued to evolve through all kinds of spaces. But the through line has always been collaboration and co-creation. And for me, leadership agility is as much about self-leadership as it is about leading others. And that's about how you show up with other people and how open you are to learning and adapting with them. And by that, in that way, hopefully setting the tone and leading others to co-create that space with you. So I would say it started out in those early rehearsal halls and just continued to come with me everywhere I've gone and worked.
And it's so interesting, the context that we bring to things. You and my good friend, Brent Darnell, who does emotional intelligence, both bring that kind of theater, improv, creative side, which I'm so envious of, having started engineer, finance, very quantitative and everything. And I think that's just such a great perspective that you bring to this. So what prompted you to write the first book? And I don't know if it was your first book, The Agility Shift, but it's the first one I found.
No, actually, that was my fourth book. This is my fifth book. So you're talking about Agility Shift. And that book was really prompted by, I was maybe 5 or 10 years out of my doctoral program, where I really focused on understanding what happens for people when they learn to improvise, and did a deep dive into the spaces we create for really great co-creation. And that evolved into a book called From Workplace to Play Space. But it came out at the height of financial crisis, and a book that the publisher priced at almost $40 on play in the workplace was not flying off the shelves. And what I realized was, you know, what people could hear about was agility and adaptation, because everybody was scrambling to find ways to stay relevant and competitive in a really volatile market. So in many ways, I shifted the language essentially from many of those early discoveries of improvisation, but refocused them to the language of what was happening in the organizations that I was working with and speaking with. And that's how The Agility Shift came out. And it's really about the mindset shift as well as the specific practice shift. And I talk about six dynamics that leaders that are really sustaining agility or leaning into agility are consistently practicing. So that was the essence of that book.
Yeah, and it is a phenomenal book. You know, when I moved to Australia in 2018, I shipped, I think, 50 books to Australia, maybe 100, I don't know. But your book was one of the precious ones that will come, that book, with me. And now your new book. So staying in the game. And I want to, before I get too far down this, can I just remind people where to find you? Where do we find Pamela Meyer? Because you're so brilliant.
Yes, it's very easy. Simply go to pamela-meyer.com and you'll find your way to me and all of my work.
So the new book, Staying in the Game, Leading and Learning with Agility for a Dynamic Future. So books are hard. I can't believe this is, what did you say, number six for you?
Number five.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. Well, they're hard. I've written a small one, and I know that. Typically someone has something to say out into the world. That's why we put the effort. What was the impetus for this book?
Well, what prompted this was, it was interesting, since the agility shift came out, and you know, like you said, writing books is hard, and the work that I was doing around agility shift was really thriving. The book was doing well. Writing is hard. And I noticed an interesting phenomena that after there, you know, huge burst of enthusiasm around all things agile, whether it was simply becoming more agile or adopting agile frameworks. Many of the clients I worked with were in the midst of agile transformations. But after that initial burst of enthusiasm or adoption, what I noticed happening was people started moving back to their comfort zones and going back to business as usual. And some of them were still invested in doing agile with a capital A, meaning some of the frameworks and methodology, but they really weren't being agile. And that this is very much a human phenomena for us to go back to our comfort zone. But at the same time this was happening, I came back to this passion from my youth, downhill skiing and alpine racing. And I had some big barriers because I hadn't skied for more than 20 years. And what I noticed when I started overcoming these barriers, I thought I was going to be the oldest one out there. It was going to be hard to adapt to the new equipment and how things were working. But I got out there, especially to the race hill, and I noticed I was one of the youngest people out there. There were people who were still racing, never taking a break. They were in their 60s, 70s, even 80s out there every weekend, every month, every year, and staying fit and really in it and still competing at the top of their game. So I had questions, you know, what was it that kept these people in it? And it started informally with chairlift conversations and then expanded to these wider conversations and interviews and in-depth research. And what I discovered was many of the things that, whether they're weekend athletes or leaders who are leading major Fortune 50 companies, they're doing many of the same things to continue to stay agile and continue to stay in that mindset of learning and adaptation. And so these two curiosities and passions came together, and that's really the heart of the book.
Wow. Isn't it so interesting? I think one of the things I really admire about you is that you are curious, you're an observer, and you look at systems and process, but you look at it from such a human standpoint. Mm-hmm. But these patterns of, you know, how is this occurring? How are we staying in the game? How are we pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone, et cetera? And you're just a really thoughtful, intelligent, curious person. So how did that thinking then transform itself into the book?
Yeah, well, you know, as you know, as a researcher and as a curious person yourself, you know, a lot of it is the patience to stay with what all of these conversations and see what's rising to the top, what are the common themes. And once I got to this point of saturation, meaning, you know, I was starting to hear similar things no matter how many people I talked to, then I thought, you know, I've really got some clarity here on things that are sustaining this kind of activity, whatever people, wherever the game is played. And for some people it was in their volunteer work, some people leading organizations, sometimes it was the weekend activities. But what grew into focus was this idea of embodied agile leadership. You know, we often act as if our work takes place from the neck up, and think of, you know, that's so much of the value that we bring. And what I discovered was that truly agile leaders are engaged with their whole selves. And, you know, we talk about gut instincts, but it's more than that. They're really paying attention to their own engagement. They're actually, most of them are taking pretty good care of themselves. Some are former athletes, not all, but there's an attunement that helps them actually be agile and show up in all kinds of contexts. And they're not just attuned to themselves, they're attuned to what's happening around them. And that extends to what's happening in the marketplace, what's happening, you know, in broader context, because we know that agile leaders have to be continually assessing and adapting to the current situation. So that was a big piece. And then I discovered some other dynamics that really that sustain this level of engagement as opposed to people starting to move back into their comfort zone.
So let's back up just a little bit. Agile leadership. What do we, and then you go into embodied agile leadership, but this is being present. But what is agile leadership and why is it important?
Yeah. I mean, truly for me, sometimes the easiest way to understand agile leadership is to think of the opposite of it. And, you know, for me, the difference between an agile leader and perhaps a leader that's more planning and control focused is that the agile leader, I might call it the disembodied leader. The disembodied leader walks into the room with this mindset of, oh, I hope nothing goes wrong. Whereas the agile leader walks into the room thinking, what's going to happen today? What am I going to learn? What are we going to create today? And they're open to surprise and possibility. And that is a very much a different mindset. It's the learning and adaptation mindset versus a planning and control mindset. And honestly, the two aren't mutually exclusive. Of course, if you're leading any kind of team or organization, there's a really important function of planning and analysis. But the opportunity is, are we doing that work still with a mindset of learning and adaptation? If there's ever a point where we're cutting ourselves off from incoming information or information coming from our embodied self that tells us, you know what, this just isn't singing. This isn't the right path. And, you know, we've all have stories in our own lives of when we've motored on despite those red flags and often, you know, paid the consequence for it. So that's the distinction.
Well, and so when we think about leadership, and this has been an ongoing debate, in fact, I just played golf at the National Academy of Construction meeting with a gentleman. He and I joined the same company around 94, 93, I think he joined and started a leadership institute there. And this debate about, are leaders born or can you create them? Mm-hmm. Like, what are these skills we can learn? Can we go from being kind of a, oh gosh, what's going to be wrong, and kind mm-hmm. of a deficit kind of thinking to more of a growth, learning, adaptation thinking as a leader?
Yes. And I'm happy to report that we can, and I've seen it. We can learn and we can make those shifts. It, you know, certainly there are personality profiles that may have some value in certain settings. And what I've found is no matter what your Myers-Briggs or DISC or any other personality assessment, people can learn to practice some core concepts that help them be more effective, giving and taking in all kinds of contexts, being effective in the midst of uncertainty. And that those do really go back to my early roots in improvisation. For many years, I taught improvisation in a higher ed setting, both undergrad and graduate students, leaders from all walks of life. I mean, mid-career, people working in various industries. And I truly saw so many people were in a panic that first day of class that they'd even signed up for a class that had improv in the description. But by the end of 10, 12 weeks, they were amazed at the level of transformation, and that was starting to spill over into their work lives, their personal lives, and simply becoming more comfortable that they did have the ability to think on their feet, to accept what happens to them that day and build on it, that they didn't have to have a death grip on the original plan. And in fact, you know, improvisers say that, you know, if you start a scene thinking you know how it's going to end, you're already in trouble. You know, that those preconceptions are often the seeds of our demise. So we need to, certainly in business, we have plans, but we need to hold those plans lightly and think of them as, you know, important for direction or vision and values clarity, but not to overly invest in them in terms of what the end result is going to look like.
I love that, having a death grip on the plan. I actually, it's kind of funny because through my work with my emotional intelligence coach, I have figured out that that is one of my biggest triggers, is when my plan gets messed up. Mm. And so me letting go of my plans is something that I've personally worked on. And to that end, so I'm teaching a course at the Australian National University right now, and I ask these MBA students to go practice a new skill, and they have to write about it 6 weeks later. And A, they all want to work on like five new skills at once, which I don't find to be effective. But getting them to drill into the behavior that they're trying to change in themselves and how that creates deeper relationships with people or whatever and related. So what are some of these skills, things that you talk about in the book that are so critical to being mm-hmm. an agile leader?
Yeah. So, I mean, and this really crosses, you know, both books that are focused on agility, but certainly and I'm with you, if we focus on too many behaviors, we're ultimately not building any. And so I use something that I first learned on the ski hill, which is slow down to go fast, which you've probably heard in other contexts, but we have to slow things down and break these skills down into their micro pieces. And it starts truly, this is where the embodied piece comes in with as simple as getting used to taking a few breaths and paying attention to what's going on. You know, I'm starting to get triggered. What's going on truly in my body? Is my heart pounding? Are my palms getting sweaty? Am I, you know, what happens for me when I start to move into that reactive mode? And I talk a lot about shifting from reactive to responsive. And they can happen in almost the same amount of time, but we just slow down enough to become aware of what's going on. And then we start having access to all of our resources. You know, in the agility shift, I talk about the relational web, our web of skills, knowledge, talent, and resources. In reactive mode, we don't have access to that. We have access to our knee-jerk responses or preconceptions or just trying to ram our plan forward. So that's the starting point, is slowing down enough to have that self-awareness. And people think that, you know, that there's not time for that. This is urgent. But truly, we're talking, you know, less than 60 seconds sometimes just to slow down. But then from there, and these are some of the things I discovered in staying in the game, it's a true awareness of and engagement with the game. And I talk about the game as, you know, whatever gives you an opportunity to play, that's play with new ideas, play new roles, an opportunity that's aligned with your purpose in some fashion or form. And that it is also gives you your sense of passion and it's pleasurable. So, you know, I call those the four P's of the game. And I'm not getting into game theory or, you know, other kinds of conceptions of the game, but just the sense of what is that joie de vivre that you experience, and when are those times that you experience it. So when we create more awareness about that, we've almost got, you know, that a litmus test or a, you know, some kind of Geiger counter that can lead us to, you know, our level of engagement. And what I found interviewing leaders across industries was that when I asked them how important that experience was to them, they simply said, I don't know. I mean, it's who I am. What came from that is that the core is truly your meaningful identity, our game, and what gives us those four P's is truly our identity, and it's where we make meaning. And it's through that these other dynamics come to life. And the intentionality of prioritizing the game, your experience of it, creating space for others to have that experience in community, which is a huge way that our meaningful identity comes into being, that we get to experience it, but we get to create it for others. And that's a huge leadership role. I mean, I saw that again and again, that truly agile, truly embodied agile leaders are not just thinking about how can I have this experience. They're very intentionally wanting to foster cultures and climate for others to have that experience too. And it's why, you know, truly great leaders have folks that have been with them for decades and continue to thrive, or maybe they've gone on to their own great things, but that's a core aspect of it.
It's interesting. I had a young student, was looking a little downtrodden in class, was being very thoughtful, and she said, gosh, there's so many bad leaders in the world. And I said, well, the good news is that you can be an amazing leader and you can have an impact on many, many people and help them show up as the best versions of themselves at work. And you know, look at it as an opportunity, because you do see a lot of bad leaders out there, unfortunately.
Right.
But just be the bright, shining beacon that's a role model for people, too, where they go, wow, those people are all having a lot of fun and they're getting crushing it in their business results. I mean, that's the thing, these high performing, fun, collaborative, joyous teams that are bringing projects in ahead of schedule, or, you know, adding shareholder value, whatever it is that they're doing. Do you think we've lost a sense of fun at work? I'm sitting here thinking, I've been working for 40 years now. It's hard to believe I was an intern in engineering school 40 years ago, but do you think that are we losing or gaining a sense of fun, camaraderie, collaboration, joie de vivre, as you say?
Yeah, I think in some ways the jury's still out. We're still in that nascent space of post-pandemic. Are we back at work? Are we, you know, are we distributed? You know, what, and different organizations are making different choices there. I certainly see the value of prioritizing it and creating space for it. And with that, I'm always wary of the forced fun kind of things. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with creating those spaces, whether it's, you know, the company outings or creating space in the physical workplace where people can hang out. And, you know, I don't know, I'm not opposed to the ping pong tables and pool, because they create that opportunity for camaraderie, for spontaneous connection. So I do think there are a lot of important relational things that happen that are also good for business when we create those spaces. And they have to be appropriate to your company culture and that group. So sometimes it's a little bit of a learning experience and testing and seeing what works and flies. But I do have concern that it's not as valued. And certainly when purse strings get tight and people start feeling constrained, those are often the first things that go out the window. And there are lots of ways that we can create those without making huge investments. So I do think that it's really critical we keep prioritizing any way we can create informal, relational, spontaneous space with each other.
Pamela, I could talk to you for hours about this book, and I really want our listeners to understand how fabulous it is and that they need to go out and snatch it off the shelves. As we are wrapping up, I'm a leader out there. I'm listening. I'm a leader at whatever level, because that's the other thing. People say, well, does this change as you rise through the ranks? Good block and tackle leadership skills, behaviors, embodiment don't change when, you know, it's the same game, no matter whether you're leading five people. And by the way, leadership is not about a title. I mean, how we influence people is not related to how many people necessarily we have reporting to us. So what are some of a couple of tips from the book that you'd like to leave our listeners with as we wrap up?
Yeah, I would say, and you're absolutely right, because leadership has to start with self-awareness and self-leadership. So that's anyone, whether you're an individual contributor or leading a major organization. And with that, and this truly comes from some of the things I saw modeled across generations and across domains, was the people that are staying in it, they keep connecting. They never stop connecting, creating spaces for connecting. They keep learning, and they're always curious. They're always trying to improve. The metaphor I have from ski racing is, no matter someone's age, they come through the finish area, they check their time, and they turn back up the hill, and they look at, oh, dang it, that was that third gate. I was a little late on that gate. I'm going to go, I can do it again. Everybody thinks they haven't had their best run. So that, and that's no matter their age. So keeping that spirit of, I haven't had my best run yet. I want to do it again. There's always, I can do it better. So that's a key factor. And then keep prioritizing and reprioritizing the things that give you energy, that are bringing value to yourself, your customers, and that are aligned with your own values. And those practices, you know, probably under the big umbrella of just keep moving, are so critical, and they inspire others to do the same, whether they're moving with you or they inspire others to move in their own directions if they're heading a different way. But it's such an important and positive aspect of self-leadership and leading others, because when people see it happening, they're inspired to do it themselves. And every organization needs that kind of generative activity to continue to sustain their success.
Yeah, someone said to me, manage your energy, not your time. And I thought, oh my gosh, that is such a great saying. You know, that one's stuck in my mind for a long time. But speaking of inspiration, Pamela, you are an inspiration. I was given so many gifts during my PhD, and the wonderful people that I met who are brilliant and curious and continue to help us understand complex ideas out in the world and how we live the best version of ourselves and how we inspire others and help others lead the best version of themselves. So congratulations on your book. I know it's going to be a huge success. And thank you so much for coming to visit us at the Greatness Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Gretchen. My pleasure.
Interested in hearing more? Visit us at greatnessconsulting.com. Thank you.